If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Andrew Crummie is a Scottish artist, designer, and the lead facilitator on the Great Tapestry of Scotland and many other tapestry projects. This is the second part of our needle exchange, and if you haven't listened to the first part of our needle exchange that came out last week, in which we do a deep dive into the Great Tapestry of Scotland, then please do go and have a listen to that. It is a piece of embroidered art that has a fantastic cultural significance, not only telling the story of Scotland, but being co-created by hundreds of stitchers from around Scotland in the period that it was made, and it is now housed in Gala Shields in its permanent exhibition space. So if you're ever in the borders area of Scotland, do be sure to check it out. This is the second part of our needle exchange, as I say, and in this we look at some of the other tapestry projects that Andrew has been involved in, including the Dundee Tapestry, the Cancer Tapestry, the Scottish Diaspora Tapestry, and the History of Europe Tapestry. It's fair to say that Andrew is a very experienced participatory arts facilitator, and the fact that the scope of the tapestries he's involved in has broadened beyond the, you know, the modest topic of the history of Scotland is a testament to his ability to not only project manage but also to create visual storytelling designs that work really well. We talk about storytelling in this medium. We talk about the way that the power of stitching and tapestry enables personal expression, even within a broad context like this. Things like the COVID Chronicle and the AIDS Quilt also being similarly collaborative, expressive projects. And obviously, because it's the second part of our needle exchange, we talk about Andrew's favourite films, books, that kind of thing. It has been a pleasure talking to Andrew. I jumped at the opportunity. Thanks once again to Sue Condry for enabling this to happen. And yeah, it's a really interesting conversation with someone who's got a unique project management skill set. And I look forward to seeing the other projects that Andrew is involved with in the future. Thanks once again for listening to the show. I will be back next week with someone from a different part of the needlework ecosphere. If you've enjoyed the show, do please leave us a review. Why not post a comment on one of the posts on the Mr. X Stitch Instagram and tell me what your favourite part of the show was. I'd love to hear from you. I'll be back next week. Enjoy the show. When you started with, and I do want to come, I want, because you said at the start, you gave me like a tease, you were like, well, I've done six other tapestries since then, so I've got a big question mark, we're going to go over those. But when you started planning out and you and Alistair Moffat got together and decided to write the history of Scotland, A, how long did that take? Were there things that you missed out? Were there things that you would have liked to have included that there just wasn't the scope or things are too similar? Can you recall?
Well, it's two things. So, like, Alistair went away and wrote the narrative. So I didn't write it with him. He went away and wrote the narrative, and then he came back and he presented this narrative, which was about, I would have said, about 70 lines. But we knew that it was going to keep growing, mm-hmm. because exactly what you said, people would come back and say, well, what about this? What about that? And why haven't you done this? Or, like, you know, like, a good question was, like, Lulu was really was a controversial issue in the Great Tapestry of Scotland, because one minute Lulu, Alistair wanted Lulu to be in the Great Tapestry of Scotland. Then I got a phone call from some of the stitchers saying, they didn't want Lulu in. They didn't like Lulu. And then Lulu was out again. Then she was in again. And eventually Jackie and I agreed, we'll just do Lulu, because she's got when she was singing Shout, she had a great red hair. And that's very stylish. So let's do that. So we did that. So you get all that sort of type of stuff about how... So things keep developing through that process of discussion and people thinking, why isn't that in, or why is that not in? And they would go through Alistair, but Alistair tended to go along with it, unless it was really outrageous, which never really happened. So, but then, of course, what happened after the Great Tapestry of Scotland was that there were a lot of the people wanted to celebrate their history. You know, there is a lot more to the Great Tapestry of Scotland beyond what's in that tapestry. So, like, the Scottish Diaspora Tapestry was involved 30 different countries around the world, stitchers from all the countries adding stories about the Scots' impact in all these different countries around the world. You know, and that was a similar level of involvement, you know, and then it just goes on and on. So the more you get into it, the more stories come out, and there's more stories that have just never been told, you know. I think that's where the interest, I think, really is. It's not necessarily about doing another one about Mary Queen of Scots, though she's very important. They're all important, but actually there's a whole vast range of stories that have not been told, and, you know, particularly I think the sort of the history of women is not well told. Right. You know, it's like it's not been at all, in many ways, not celebrated at all. You know, it's really hidden. I'm listening to a really interesting book just now about the history of women in England. And that's it's very interesting, because it's a very different perspective from if it was a male history of England, you know. So, and the other thing is the multiculturalism, I think, and what all those elements is. That's a big issue as well, and, you know, so it's that needs to be developed and tackled, and understand more what these stories are, and how do you tell them, and etc. Can you do it through stitch? Which I think you can. It's very, very, very interesting. I mean, the whole thing about embroidery, the history of embroidery is really a multicultural history that goes back a long, long way, all the way to China. You know, it's the route of the Silk Road, the history of that, and, you know, things like the Paisley pattern, you know, that doesn't really come from Paisley, it goes all the way back to China. So it opens up all these really rich cultural stories to be told in stitch form, I think. Yeah. You know. And some of the history, of course, is very dark, very difficult, but I still think they all need to be told, you know. So it's interesting.
Yeah, I remember, I've said it to lots of people, I remember I went to the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, and at that time I'd been being Mr. X Stitch, I don't know, maybe about 6 years, because I started my blog in 2008, and that was kind of when I started paying attention to this stuff properly. And I was staring at this, like, medieval embroidery. It was Japanese, and it was from, like, 750 BC or something. And I just sort of like, oh, my God, you know, suddenly just getting a proper sense of, like, the history of it and the fact that this stuff is, like, woven throughout culture in a way that there aren't really that many other mediums that are. Because oil painting wasn't invented until a certain point or whatever, you know, and needle and thread predates an awful lot of stuff. And people have been making or expressing themselves with a needle and thread for tens of thousands of years, probably.
Yeah, so if you go back to the sort of beginning of the first artifacts that you get in Europe, the little sculptures that are all dotted around Europe, because I'm doing this for the History of Europe Tapestry, and there's this amazing stitcher called Frances Gardner who's been doing this research, and she stitched it, and the relationship between stitching patterns and ceramic patterns go right back to the very beginning of man making marks, because these very simple shapes that you can make with embroidery are very similar to pottery marks that you get at Stonehenge and before, all the way back to just after the Ice Age. You know what I mean? That this sort of way of the circles and the simple pattern making would have started around in that period. And I think the birth of embroidery or stitching would have been in that time as well. But it's very closely related to what would be the first art forms.
And I wonder whether that's part of the appeal, why it resonates so strongly with people for this kind of form of documentary as well.
Yeah, because it's a very ancient craft form, it's a very important craft form. I mean, the only reason we don't know that much about it is because a lot of these things don't last, whereas the stone carvings and ceramic pots have survived. But so the Bayeux Tapestry was just a sort of stepping stone of a part of a very long and very rich international global story. You know, I think that embroidery is I think that's why it has potency, because it's this very ancient art form that is sort of in more recent years been neglected, is not celebrated as much as it maybe should be.
How much negotiation was there between the designs you'd drawn when you did your plan for the Tapestry of Scotland and then when they're like interpreted through stitch? How much kind of was it fairly similar to the original intention, or did you have to then like reconfigure some of your illustrations to suit the medium?
Well, it depends on the group and it depends on the people involved, but I always design things, because it has to, when you create something, you have to create something as robust that will hopefully survive the turn of people going, well, I'm not sure about that. You've got to be aware that's probably going to happen. So you've got to design it in a way where it is flexible, because as soon as you stand up and say, you're doing what I'm telling you, it's not going to happen. You're going to lose a lot of people, because the whole point is to gather as many people as possible. So you have to design it in a way where, as I said before, you know what it's going to look like at the end, but you know that almost 90% of the people there are going to want to change. And so in a way you sort of want to celebrate that. But there are people who just look at your work and think, he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's not even a historian or whatever. They just look at you like you think, oh, well, here we go again. And you sort of like, but actually that's part of the process. So, it's like, I don't set myself up as a guru. I set myself up, everything's flexible, everything can be changed, or we can develop it, or whatever. Sometimes I had to redraw a whole panel. I think the Battle of Sheriff Muir, I had to go up to Dunblane and met the amazing stitcher Maud Crawford, and she didn't like the design I did for the Battle of Sheriff Muir, so I had to redesign it completely. But that's part of the process. That's fine. It was great that she cared about it and she had information that was actually I didn't have. So we went to the battle site and we walked around it, and her and her husband told me what should happen, what shouldn't happen. So everything and anything can happen. And other times people just accept what I draw, that's generally not the case.
So you've done the Great Tapestry of Scotland, History of Scotland, tick. So now then, so let's talk about the Dundee Tapestry, because that one, I guess, is a more scaled down version. I'm not saying it necessarily is any easier to execute, but the scale of the storytelling, presumably a bit more narrow. Can you dive into that for me?
So the Dundee Tapestry came about, my first encounter was that through Brian Beatty and Alistair Moffat. We met up. And when Dundee was applying to be City of Culture or something like that, We had a meeting about it, but it never really developed beyond that. And then the Great Tapestry went to Dundee, and then the Scottish Diaspora Tapestry went to Ferdinand Works in Dundee. And then a guy called John Flynn went to see the Game of Thrones tapestry in Belfast, and his wife said, "Oh, we should do this for Dundee." So he came back, and he got in contact with a woman called Frances Stevenson, who was head of textiles at the time at Duncan Jordanston. And then eventually, through a friend, they got in contact with me, and then I got involved with that quite a few years ago. And we developed to create a thing about telling the story of Dundee. And as I say, it involved about 140 stitchers, but I think it involves a lot more than that. And opened in the V&A, and it was a massive hit in the V&A. It was extraordinary what happened. And it's happening today. It just opened again about 10 days ago in the V&A, because people were complaining that they'd taken it down.
It's a lot more circular. Each of the panels is a kind of circular.
Yes. Design. So it's 35 circular designs. So it's a slightly different grid behind it. It's a slightly different template, and it's more about. I've drawn sort of central images, but it's that other people drawing parts of it as well. So it's much more towards getting people to add their story. So there's more of that happening in this.
I guess you're sort of leaning into that, whereas that would have been a point of nervousness with the Great Tapestry. Here, you've built in that kind of room to manoeuvre.
I think it's just experience, and that's where it's like the Cancer Tapestry is the same. In fact, all the new ones are the same. They're much more about encouraging people to stitch and draw their own image. You know, so it's more about these sort of hidden stories, secret stories, stitcher
also,
stories.
Also, it's like you then get like a local dialect, don't you? It's like different accents coming across. Yeah. You're speaking in a language, and then they're just these regional variations.
Yeah, I'm not going to go up to Dundee and tell people of Dundee, although I went to Dundee Art College. I'm not going to tell them their history, and you wouldn't get away with that anyway. So it's like, you know, I wouldn't do that. That's not what it's about. It's about if you can get if you can get a lot of people together who want to tell a story, I think you can create a sort of giant community arts embroidery. I think it's quite possible, you know, but you have to know how to do it, I think. You know, you have to have some knowledge of how that works.
Mm. You know,
Not every artist can do this.
No, no, and I think that's where it's interesting. It's interesting that, because, I mean, you started out in a kind of corporate realm, didn't you? You did a lot of that kind of mural work before you did a shopping centre in Oldham. That was like, was that a quarter of a mile long? Is that right?
It was a quarter of a mile long round a new shopping centre in Oldham. But that was community-based, so there was all these different community groups, and we painted it about 2 weeks. But the build-up to that, creating the structure and organising that, that's mm-hmm. what I was doing. So I sort of had a good idea. I was beginning to learn how to do this way of working, where you can involve a lot of people to make an artwork. But that same principle is what applies to the Great Tapestry of Scotland. That's why I wasn't frightened of doing it, because I knew that you could do these giant public artworks, community artworks, and involve a lot of people at the same time. But you've got to learn a way of containing the information and make it so it's readable. But yeah, a quarter of a mile long mural and painted in 2 weeks is sort of a nuts thing to do, but it is quite possible.
So then you've got the Dundee Tapestry, then the Cancer Tapestry, then different subject matter, same like application, same principle, but tell us about that one.
So in 2017, I got diagnosed with throat cancer, and I began treatment. And my friend Fraser McLean, who's an animator who lives in Mexico and has worked for Disney and that, he said there was this guy Rod Mountain wants to get in contact with you. So I was sitting in the Great Western Hospital in Edinburgh getting pumped full of chemo, and this guy phoned me up and he goes, My name's Rod Mountain. I'm an ENT surgeon from Ninewell, Dundee. See, when you get better, would you like to do a cancer tapestry? And I thought, oh my God, this guy thinks I'm going to live.
Okay.
So,
cheers.
So yeah, cheers. So, and it's, and, but that night I thought about it and I thought, you know, actually, I could, if I do get through this, this is my way of giving something back to the NHS and all the great, all the treatments that you get and everything, and, you know, and understanding it is. And that's what's happened. So it's like, I'm an oncologist at the time. She's involved with it as well, Dr. Ian Nixon. And we're now up to, we've got 6 finished panels. We've got another, I think, 10, 12 on the go. And it's just getting stronger and stronger. We've done about 7 exhibitions this year, all sorts of things. But again, it's stitching. It's people telling their story. They're people telling their story of cancer. Maybe somebody they've lost. Maybe they're living with cancer. Maybe they've got over. Maybe they've given all clear like me. Or they just want to tell a story of cancer. But a lot of people are willing to get involved. And so there's a documentary about it being made by a guy called John Gill, which is now an award-winning documentary. And that tells some of these stories, some of the stitchers telling these really moving stories of cancer to people that also, different stories of cancer. But they're just very touching. That they're not for everyone, but it is. They are definitely sort of moving and touching, you know. So, but that's a developing tapestry project. You know, it's on a big journey at the moment. You know, it's really developing quite fast.
There's a project it's making me think of that's called the COVID Chronicles, which was a similar kind of concept where people, it was a bit more kind of global, but people were invited to interpret their experiences of COVID using textile art and that same sort of thing, you know. And I think those are really profound because, as we said before, like the effect that stitching something has on someone when they're dwelling in it, you know, people doing those kind of really personal, painful stories, you hope that there's a rehab function there, but it's got to be quite the journey to go on to be sitting in that space when you're making that stuff.
Yeah, I think I've been in contact with people. I think the COVID Chronicles, I think it's the COVID Chronicles, maybe the COVID Tapestry as well, I'm not quite sure, but there was a couple actually thinking about, but yeah, absolutely, for people telling their stories, they're really powerful, the stories. The stories they tell, you know, it's hopefully it will influence hopefully the COVID inquiry, because I've designed a small panel for that as well, which is a woven panel, but the COVID Chronicles or the COVID Tapestry, I can't quite remember it. They did this huge piece, which is great. It's really fantastic, and it needs to be shown and celebrated and given more prominence. I'm all for all things like that. You know, I think it's not about one person. It's about lots of people coming together, and you know, the more of it, the better.
Yeah, and again, I think the medium, a lot of the time, when there are subject matters that can be quite controversial or painful, sometimes the softness of the medium helps mitigate that for other people. You know, I've seen quite hardcore topics being explored, but because they're done with a needle and thread, it dismantles some of the, like, the mindset that you're going to get, because the medium, like, I don't want to say obfuscates a fancy word, but do you know what I mean? It kind of just makes it more palatable for people a lot of the time.
Yeah, sometimes, and other people just won't look at it because it's just too difficult, you know. And like, I had to design a panel for the COVID inquiry, and I had to work with the Scottish Bereaved Group, and I worked with the group online because it was just at the end of the COVID, and they told me these terrible stories. They're just awful stories of what happened, and your heart just goes out to them. It's just so sad, the stories they're telling. And my job was just to try and to create one image that they felt would represent their stories, you know, and you know, and hopefully I was able to do that. But they are very powerful stories. They're, you know, and the same way you get in the COVID Chronicles and other. I mean, this type of thing goes back to the AIDS quilt. You know, that's the thing. But they are powerful. They can change things. You know, in format. I think it does make it a little bit more palatable, but at the same time, it's sort of, you are documenting sort of really difficult stories, but I think those difficult stories need to be told, you know. If it better understanding, I think it's a good thing.
Then now you're doing the modest project of the history of Europe. In its just the history of Europe now.
Yeah, well, this has been a long project. It started with Alistair during Brexit, but it didn't really work in Brexit because certainly the tapestries I'm involved with, they're not political beasts. You know, I mean, they're not. There's no way that the Great Tapestry of Scotland is an independence tapestry or pro-union tapestry. It's because if you're involved with 1,000 people, you know, half of them were for the union, half of them were for independence. So you have to sort of go above. You have to sort of go above that. So we started this idea of a tapestry for Europe, and Alistair again laid out a narrative, and it sort of meandered a wee bit. We're up to about 4 panels, so it's a much slower process, but we've got these sort of the beginnings of the migration routes stitched across Europe, because how Europe was populated was a sort of slow migration route from sort of Turkey, Syria, all the way right across to Scotland and Norway, Sweden, etc. You know, so it's a really interesting thing. We've done one panel about Stonehenge, and we've got another couple of panels about all these amazing sculptures and really ancient artworks that were found in Europe, which is really a fascinating thing. Which I enjoy about it. It's about you learn all these things that I never knew anything about. The artworks that are just that define our culture or culture, whatever you want to say. It's if you can just enjoy that, I think, through Stitch, I think it's
quite a neat trick if you can tell the story, like, objectively. Like, that's one of the things I felt with the Tapestry of Scotland, is it's, like you say, it's apolitical. It's kind of like a calm celebration. Like, it's not overstated or understated. It's quite sort of neutral in its approach, and it just tells the story and allows you to, like, beat up against it. The history, I mean, even if you went to tapestryofeurope.com and you look at the panels page, where the descriptions of all the panels are, like, the panels haven't been made. But even that, you're like, well, there's a good history of Europe in the first place. Do you know what I mean? And I think
it's a very good history. But it's just the starting point, as it was in the Great Tapestry of Scotland. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It's like, well, that goes right back to the Battle of Preston. For me, the Battle of Preston Pans. You know, the Battle of Preston Pans tapestry was about the born Prince Charlie, the Jacobite victory, Preston Pans. Now you're either for Bonnie Prince Charlie and the Jacobites, or you don't like Bonnie Prince Charlie and the Jacobites, you know, or, you know, it's not the English army, it's the British army. But it's, so some people really like Bonnie Prince Charlie, other people don't like Bonnie Prince Charlie, so it's controversial. But my job was just to tell the story. So I don't take sides when it comes to things like this. What you've got to do is create a clear narrative. So you can have discussions about it, but when you're trying to sort of uncover the truth and a sort of clear visual narrative, that sort of opinions, I would suggest, I try not to have them, because it help. You know, I've got my own personal views about Bonnie Prince Charlie. It didn't come into that project. Yeah. for me, you know, it's to tell.
And it's interesting because I was thinking just when you were talking back about the panel that you did for the COVID inquiry, I would imagine that that's probably the hardest storytelling of all, because when you've got 100 panels or 80 panels or something, you've got an opportunity to spread your storytelling. You can kind of dilute it a bit, whereas a single image is arguably harder, I would have thought.
It's much, much harder to design because it's got to, and it's got to be simple. Well, for me, it's got to be simple because it's like, because as you say, I started off as an illustrator and a sort of realist for the Midland Bank corporate. So it's all about just creating really simple imagery that can be either printed or painted on a wall, you know. So I think there's a great skill to that. I mean, Banksy is like, he's very good at that type of thing, you know, the same thing. It's just it's like it's what you leave out the image to make it more poignant. That's the difficult thing, and every time you've got to think that through, you know, that is a skill in its own right. You know, that's what your job is to create something that is fit for purpose, that will actually sort of work within the context of what you've been given. And it's like, you know, less is more, you know, the simpler the better, you know.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because who would have thought, like, when you were working for, like, the New Musical Express or you had those kind of clients, who would have thought that edited down storytelling is still the thing that's going to end up persisting?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. My very first publication was, I did the letters page for NME, you know, the art director there, Joe Ewart, gave me my first commission, which was great. And but if I had thought then that I would end up doing these giant tapestries, I would have. What is that about? But it was all about distilling imagery down to, you know. I wouldn't say I'm a great draftsman or anything. But what I'm good at is distilling things down to simple imagery, and that works really well for Stitch because you've got to design. You've got to draw for Stitch. You've got to leave a lot of things out so somebody can stitch. So it's not as though you can just, anybody can do it. You've got to learn how to draw for Stitch. It's actually quite a particular thing, you know. But there are different ways of doing it. My way is not the only way. But for me, I think it's always a learning process, but it is about, it's what you leave out, you know, you leave out.
It really reminds me, and I'm no expert on this, but it really reminds me of kind of classical music composition, in which you're telling a story over a period of time, you're working with different elements, be it strings or woodwind or another musical section. But also the fact that, like, you know, as I said early on, when I walked around the tapestry, I was aware of chords that would come back, different parts of the story that would reappear through your choice of, like, you know, illustration and icons and those kind of things. And it's similar. I was trying to think of something, but I'm not well versed enough, but like Peter and the Wolf, or one of those kind of stories where characters come back and you know they're back because of the musical bits that are interfaced. And it's almost like your version of storytelling is akin to that.
That's right. So it's like within these sort of template sort of structures for these tapestries, there are repeat things that will hopefully make it easier to read. So I listen to a lot of music when I'm designing these things. I like music a lot. And I think that's your analogy is really spot on, because, like, say, the Scottish Diaspora Tapestry is all about, because it was 307 panels, and there were smaller panels, it was all about repeating a lot of the same things that will be reinterpreted, but at the same time, they are the same image almost, or the same pattern, and then but you're revisiting things, and you're slightly talking them again, but all that sort of got to be worked out. So you've got to know where everything's going to go, so when it all slots together, in my head, it will work. But what happens is, people then think, oh no, You can display it this way, you can display it that way. So then my sort of way of constructing it gets thrown out the window. But the actual panels are still there, you know, because the Scottish Diaspora Tapestry, I did design it a certain way. For me, it makes sense. And the Great Tapestry is the same, and the Dundee Tapestry was the same. Mm. They're all the same. Because the other thing about these tapestries is you may start off with just a couple of panels, but I'm often conscious that it may end up, you may go to 100 panels, you know. The cancer tapestry may go to 100 panels, may go to more, or it may get to a point where other people are designing them or whatever. So you've got to work all that out, you know. So it's like, and how is that going to work? And, you know, so, but each one's slightly different. And so, you have to think.
You've got to hope that you've written a piece for the flute. You hope that someone at least tries to play it with a recorder and not just a set of spoons or something.
Yeah, but that's what happens. So it's like, you know, you just have to sort of, it's sort of like if people knew what I was thinking about when I'm designing these things, they think the guy's mad, you know. It's like, you know, it's like, because what you're thinking about is patterns, how you put things together, what happens if you move that over, to there, that will change things, so you better have it there. And actually, I've got lots of sketches, I do lots of sketches, digital and proper sketching, where I'm working all these things out, you know, and it's like, you know, what goes, where does it go, what does it do, what if you do this and you do that, and then eventually you come out with a sort of a structure, hopefully, which will work, but, you know, will probably be thrown out anyway. So it's like, you know, you just, it's interesting. You know,
now,
so.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to take the musical metaphor and I'm going to apply it to my next line of inquiry, which are the tough questions, because we've done the how do you make a tapestry that covers the history of Europe and all that easy stuff. So now I'm going to ask you, do you have a favourite band or do you have a favourite album? Not or, and.
Well, I have thought about this, and my favourite album, it changes from week to week, but I think probably Songs in the Key of Life by Stevie Wonder, I think, is a revisited album. But I have got, because I listen to music a lot, and there's these CDs that are attached to a lot of these tapestries, because I do listen to a lot of music when I'm doing these things. So, but on a personal level, I have a big studio, and I have friends who live around here and a couple of visitors from there. So we have a vinyl club once a month. In my studio, we play vinyl. And so I was discussing this last Saturday with them, what I was going to do, but maybe the Double White Beatles thing, but probably Stevie Wonder, the Songs in the Key of Life, I think, is more. But there are so many.
Say, for instance, with the tapestry, would you listen to a certain genre of music in order to maintain a certain genre of design, or does it not work like that?
Yeah, no, I do. That's right. No, it's like the or it gets me in the mood for something, or often I have a favourite song that I listen to over and over again when I'm doing a painting or I'm doing a design that will associate with that tapestry or with a tapestry or a painting, like the Dundee tapestry. I did listen to an awful lot of Michael Mara, who's a songwriter from Dundee. He's amazing. But then there's also a guy called Gary Clark who did Mary's Prayer. Danny Wilson, he's a friend of mine. And so I was listening to all that, and there's a great amount of music came out of Dundee. So on my Spotify list, I've got that list. I've got my Dundee tapestry playlist. I've also got my Scottish Diaspora playlist, and also my Great Tapestry of Scotland playlist. But I've got other playlists still to do. But I do listen to an awful lot of.
Can you get a Dundee state of mind, a bit like a New York state of mind?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Don't even go there.
That's good. My favourite Stevie Wonder album, for what it's worth, is Music of My Mind, which wasn't one I really knew at first, but there's a couple or three tunes on there that, because I've got a record player in our dining room and I put that on more than my kids realise or whatever, because it's just, Stevie on the right, you like, I don't know, the guy's brilliant. Love him. Can't put a foot wrong, isn't he?
Just
awesome. Do you have a favourite film?
I have lots of films that are really, every week's a different one, but probably something I've gone back to time and time again is probably Lord of the Rings. I have to say that first three. I just for some reason like Lord of the Rings, and I do like the heavy metal guys that are the orcs. And...
But there's also, I mean, in fairness, like I'm thinking of like Galadriels and all those kind of things, and then I'm thinking of some of the design details in some of your work. There's a sort of, I don't know how you call it, like there's a leaning in an ecclesiastical direction, or there's a something. There are definite notes you can see in the visual language of those two things.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my work is, I mean, probably inspired, like, glass, Gothic stained glass windows, Child Ray Macintosh. I'm quite traditional in a lot of things in my drawing. So a lot of things that I sort of lean into. Pictish drawings is a big thing for me. Ancient, simple drawing forms is another big thing for me. But I'm really somebody that I'm somebody that basically draws and paints, you know. So yeah. I'm somebody that draws, you know. So I'm
happy. Have you actually done much stitching? Do you do much yourself? Did you do much on the panels?
No, I'm very. My wife's done more stitching than me, and she never wants to be mentioned. But it's actually without Carmel, a lot of this couldn't have happened. The very first tapestry, the Battle of Preston Pans, Gordon Preston Grange said to me, we should do the Battle of Preston Pans tapestry. And I thought, oh God, it's another crazy idea. I went back and I said this to Carmel, and Carmel said, oh, I can stitch, and I didn't know that. And so she actually did the first sample with my neighbour, and she's done a fantastic panel. She stitched most of the tapestries, but she's also stitched an amazing panel which tells our family history of cancer in the cancer tapestry. And so she is an amazing right. woman, and a very skilled stitcher, but she wouldn't let me mention
the fact that your professional tapestry. Trajectory has been fundamentally altered by a skill that she just happened to mention that one time.
Yes,
that's off to the ladies, and that's always the way. Do you have a favourite book?
So the probably the books I'm sort of reading at the moment is probably more I was listening to, I think that the Tapestry of Time is quite an interesting book. I wouldn't say it's my favourite book, but it's a really interesting book. But the one I really enjoyed recently was Poor Things with what's his name? Oh, it's gone out of my head now. Alexander right. Gray. Yeah, Alistair Gray. Poor Things, which is made into a big film, which is because it's a sort of Scottish version of Frankenstein, H.G. Wells, Gothic, Sherlock Holmes, a whole series of pastiches all wrapped into one. And it's a really clever yes. book. So it's a really enjoyable. But I like Frankenstein because I did, my daughter actually, who's an illustrator come animator, she likes Frankenstein, and my degree work when I finished student at Dundee was Frankenstein. So, so Frankenstein. But this Alistair Gray's Scottish version of Frankenstein.
The title being "Poor Things: Episodes from the Early Life of Archibald McCandless, M.D., Scottish Public Health Officer." Nice. So
yes, that's right.
But I was going to say the film with Emma Stone that's recently come out, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah,
I have to knock that up my list because that was done by the same director who did a film called The Lobster a little while ago, and I remember going to see that, and that was just like, huh? Because I think it ends at the end, and you're like, huh? And I always like a film like that where you just walk away pondering exactly what you've just seen, something like that.
Yeah, the book's really. I think the book. And I like the film. I thought the film was really good, but the book is better. Right.
I put that on my list. I'm going to put that. I put this on my list. Every time someone says a really good book, I write it down. I think I'll get that for my wife for Christmas. And now she's got this little collection of books on her shelf that I got her for her birthday. I'm like, when are you going to read those books? They're supposed to be really good. So they end up doing them themselves. Is there an interesting fact that not a lot of people know about Andrew Crummie?
Well, there is. So it's like the... If you go to, it's a bit of a story, but I'll give it softly. If you go to Craigmillar, where I was born, there's a statue to my mother, It's the story of the violin, and it's actually the story rotates around my older brother Philip when he wanted to learn to play the violin, and out of the story, the Craigmore Festival Society started, and this sort of community arts movement that you get in Scotland comes from that story, which is a whole story in itself. But the big reveal is that I did learn to play the violin. So when I was but that statue is not me. That's of my. It's actually just any right. child. That's the whole point. That every child is creative. If anybody's creative, that's the whole point. But the actual people often say to me, is that statue of you? It's not of me. I didn't learn the violin. That story's not of me, but
so there is a statue in Craig Miller, not of Andrew Crummy. That's good. Apparently there's a statue that's not of Jamie Chalmers as well, but I don't really like to bring it up. It's a bit awkward to say that right this time. Fantastic. Andrew, thank you so much for having the Needle Exchange with me.
Okay.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's needle.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needle exchange. See you next time.